This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One. I'm Greta Mart.
Frank Lloyd Wright remained 60 years after his passing as America's seminal architect. Wright, born on the heels of the Civil War, produced seminal residential and commercial projects up until his passing in 1959. A pride and joy in Florence, Alabama, is Wright's Rosenbaum residence, built in 1939. Even though America was still in the midst of the Great Depression, visionaries like Frank Lloyd Wright and his clients, such as the Rosenbaum family in Florence, Alabama, were taking the long view and didn't let the economy stop them from dreaming and actualizing their visions. The Rosenbaum home is now owned by the city, and it's open year-round for public tours. I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me at Frank Lloyd Wright's Rosenbaum residence for a conversation with architect and Wright aficionado Robert Witten. Witten shares insights about how the Alabama home served as a trendsetter in Wright's vision for affordable Usonian homes in America, and his relationship with the Rosenbaums and their home since Witten was a teenager. Wright's dramatic and expensive projects such as Falling Water in Pennsylvania receive ample attention due to their extraordinary visual appeal integrated with dramatic rural settings. But Wright was equally motivated to develop affordable housing for the common folk, dubbed Usonian, as in United States, North America. His home's designs were predicated on simple, cost-effective building practices such as single-story construction, efficient square footage, no attics, no basements, integral radiant heating along with passive solar orientation, and ample use of natural light and minimal interior walls. Now let's join Robert Witten.
If happy little bluebirds fly beyond the rainbow, why, oh, why can't I?
Here we are in Alabama, and a surprising gift for me is Frank Lloyd Wright's presence here.
Oh, you're in Florence, Alabama, Lauderdale County, northwest corner of the state. This house is the only Frank Lloyd Wright building in the state of Alabama. Very few in the south.
An anomaly, isn't it?
Somewhat. The Rosenbaum newlyweds, Stanley and Mildred Rosenbaum. Mildred, call her Mimi sometimes. She was from New York City, and Stanley met her on a trip up there. He fell in love, proposed. She said yes, so she came to Florence, and she told me one time, she first thing she wanted to know was, did Florence have paved streets? Which then was a yes and no answer. So they were given $7,500, which is quite a sum in 1938-39, to buy or build a house. And she told me that, well, we looked around town, and we did not see anything we really wanted to buy, so we got a friend of ours, Aaron Green, who had just come back from Cooper Union in architecture, and he designed them a house. And Mimi said, well, we really didn't like what Aaron had done. And they went back to Aaron, and he, in so many words, said, why don't you just get Frank Lloyd Wright to do it? Because Aaron started out in graphic design, and when he saw some publications of Frank Lloyd Wright, became smitten. So that was his hero, kind of like mine when I was younger. Aaron was the matchmaker. He wrote the letter to Mr. Wright. In so many words, I've got clients I want you to take. Wright later would say that he was impressed by this. He said, most people are trying to take jobs away from me. Very few people bring them to me. So everything was done in correspondence. I don't believe the Rosenbaums met Mr. Wright in 1939. The rendering was sent, and it was dated September the 1st of 1939.
So did they send him a topo and some photos?
Yes.
So he worked from that.
He
right?
did. He worked
so
from that.
He never physically came on site.
He never came to Alabama, probably for several different reasons, but one reason that I remember reading was that the state of Alabama wanted him to buy a license to practice architecture. I think it was about $50, and telling a 73-year-old Frank Lloyd Wright that he needed a license to practice architecture rubbed him the wrong way. So I guess he was tired of being in jail and off and on. So he said, well, I just won't go. And somehow they kind of danced around each other and got it done. Of course, Wright did send an apprentice. Burt Goodrich was the apprentice on the original house. But yes, Wright had the topos. And at that time, you could have seen the Tennessee River, which was quite lovely. This was the edge of town on this side. So that was 1939. They started construction, and it was finished in the fall of 40, give or take. Mimi said it took about 10 months to build. I think her clock started a little bit earlier, probably when they got the rendering. She probably, because I believe it was around August or maybe September when the family moved in.
This is the antithesis in some respects of Falling Waters, for example. It's very minimalist and very utilitarian.
Correct.
Talk to us about what strikes you most profoundly about this specific architecture.
The Usonian concept, which Wright had a lot of bits and pieces in his mind for quite some time, but the seed germ idea of these houses was to eliminate the unnecessary. Mm-hmm. And it explains just about everything. The flat roofs, though not all Usonians had flat roofs, but the first early ones did. The concrete floors, no gutters and downspouts. There's no paint except on the floor. There's no sheetrock or gypsum or plaster. He tried to do where your first step is your last step in construction to save time and money. So now these would be the antithesis of his prairie homes, which was a different era. That you would have a wing on a prairie home, and if you look at the plan, it'd be servant, servant, servant. They'd have a three-bedroom house for just their help. This was just the opposite. This is
total square footage again?
The original house was around 1,500, and then the addition added another 1,000, so you're right around 2,500 square feet.
Talk to us about lighting and natural lighting, because you have some contradictions. You have a lot of minimalistic clerestory, and then you have where we're sitting, for example, floor to ceiling.
First of all, the house is oriented to the sun. It's facing the south-southwest, and it is an L shape, which forms somewhat of a sun trap, which not quite lighting, but this is solar. He was that many generations ahead of his time on passive solar heating. And, of course, on the lighting, the whole south end of the home is French doors, fixed glass, other things like that. And you do have the clear stories, the natural light, which also helps not only bring in lighting because the colors are, well, somewhat dark. You got red brick and you got the browns of the wood, etc. So you need as much light as possible. But also with his construction, his detailing, it also gives a sense of transparency. You can stand in the living room and look to the east and you could see out of the clerestory, but you just look 10 inches down and you're inside the home.
So it's also that sense of privacy, right?
Yeah. At the museum, there's no curtains, but when the family lived here, of course, they were all curtains. And Wright would say about the Usonians, and maybe the rest of his work, is to turn your back on the street and face nature. And this house is a perfect example of that, with the north wall, little fenestration as possible on the north, and it just so happens that that was the street side, and I think it just worked out perfectly.
A quick moment on heating and air, FAU. What was built in for a heating system and cooling at that time?
He heated the house with radiant floor heat. That's one reason why he liked the concrete floor. It would give him a heat sink from the sun, and then 2-inch iron pipe set in the gravel. It wasn't inside the concrete slab. It was so early that the pipe were in the gravel, and you pour the slab on top of it. And then you would heat the floor that way.
And that was a water?
Yes, it was a boiler. Original house was all electric. He did that because Wilson Dam kilowatt hours were pennies. So he wanted to tout the new Wilson Dam, etc. Now, in the addition, they went to oil for some unknown reason. I don't know. But it was still all floor radiant heat. And my first trip here as a teenager in 1971, it still worked. And I can remember sitting on the couch, and the floor was then carpeted. I was able to put my hand on the floor and it was just nice and warm. It was so very pleasant.
Were you a university student at that time?
I was a freshman at Florence State, which is UNA now. Stanley was an English professor. I had already set up to transfer to Auburn University for my architectural degree, but this is hometown. And
you met him when you were a student then?
Yes, sir. And I had to build up the courage to go introduce myself and say, I'm interested in architecture and I love Frank Lloyd Wright. I want to come see your house. And he said, okay, fine, I'll give us a call. And I did, made an appointment and came over. And he and Mebe told me a little bit about the house and stuff. Got to walk around. And I stayed in contact with him. When I moved to Auburn, I was able to arrange three more trips with friends and was able to arrange the entire third year of architecture to come up and tour the house.
One of my things I love about Frank Lloyd Wright is his holistic approach to architecture, carrying forth to furniture. And why not talk to us about how it applied here in this construction?
Well, the furniture was part of the blueprints. And most of, I guess the very first, of course I wasn't around then, but the whole thing was full of original Frank Lloyd Wright designed plywood furniture and a little upholstery. And as time went on, some pieces were given to their help. Stanley got a little bit tired of the plywood furniture and gave those to their help and some other things. But there is still one armchair left original. I'm somewhat biased, but a nice thing that was saved.
These little boxes over there, are those original?
The ottomans, yes. Mm-hmm. The table, to the best of my knowledge, all of that, Mimi would have, pretty much everything that I say was my memories of talking with Miss Rosenbaum.
But definitely like that Eames-esque chair, no.
That was after the fact, and when I knew the family, they were all over the place. Mm-hmm. Now, the silver set in their living room next to the fireplace, that's original, and that's made out of the cypress plywood. And you notice the little yellow tint to the wood. Originally, the ceiling panels in the original house was cypress plywood.
And it was all regionally sourced?
I believe the cypress came from, if it wasn't Louisiana, it was from Florida. But we do have a cypress creek, so cypress is a native wood. And I believe that Wright had specified redwood, and when Stanley said, well, we can get cypress cheaper, Wright was elated because everybody knows cypress is highly weather resistant and perfect wood for a natural house, which does need some maintenance.
Okay, stepping away from the house, closing your eyes, and now you visualize the Rosenbaum house. What first comes to mind in your mind? What is most exceptional, most visual, most dramatic?
Stepping away, closing my eyes, the blending of his architecture to the site, how calm and reposeful the home is on the land. And I think what a good job the restoration people did. I think the city of Florence had acted very wisely, investing the money in saving this structure. Well, you wouldn't be here. So that's what I see. I just...
When this house was brand new, what was the reaction? And then the evolution over time as to the appreciation for what they have here.
Mimi told me a story Sunday afternoons after church lunch. A caravan of cars coming down the street, Riverview Drive, and just kind of driving slowly by the house while it was under construction. Of course, nobody ever seen. This was probably the first concrete slab house in town.
So it was the talk of the town then.
But pretty much. And she always got a chuckle out of those stories. And of course, having the cantilevered carport. I mean, who's seen that? Nobody. And there was a few articles in the paper, like in the gossip sections and things, that's been saved and scanned. I'm sure there'd been some people that did not have the taste for organic design. Mm-hmm. But mostly, as far as I know, to the best of my knowledge, it was well-received, as well as the family themselves.
And today?
Well, today the house has got, I don't know how many thousand people come each year, but it's up 7,000, 8,000, 9,000 a year come from all over, not only the nation, but I take tours through every other Sunday, and I've had a family from Switzerland, people from Belgium, Manchester, England, Lyon, France, Germany, Deutsche, and Australia, New Zealand, Tokyo, Turkey, on and on and on.
Does the roof leak, did it leak when the house was new?
I can't say from the house was new, but when I knew the family from the 70s on till now, yes, the roof, to the best of my knowledge, has had three roofs on it. The first roof was 2 inches of cement and horsehair. It's called wear coat, and it's shown on the drawings, and Mimi told me about that. Of course, the framing is flat, and then they would put the felts down for the waterproofing, and then the wear coat would be the ballast to protect the felts. But it would have had a slight taper. You could have troweled it on. All of these roofs are fairly small, and the idea was to let the water just roll over the edge. Well, that lasted 30 years, which is that's really good. Yeah. And then in 69 and 70, they did a major renovation, and they replaced the roof. And they always checked with Taliesin when they did anything. And that's why Wright called them the perfect clients. Well, this time, Taliesin specified an oddball built-up roof. It was 9 plies of canvas set in latex paint. And she told me how they would lay it down, they would paint the latex on there, and then 90-degree, and it was just a built-up roof. And I thought, well, that was odd for Alabama and stuff. And then I finally realized that, of course, this was after Wright's death. Canvas was used extensively at Taliesin West. And I think it was, I hate to say it, monkey see, monkey do. And that roof only lasted about 15 years. And then at most, I say lasted that long. I know that after Stanley died, Mimi had people to sit the house, and I was one of them. And that was the reason why. As soon as I heard thunder, there was a stack of towels like pancakes, and I would get them out, and I knew where the leaks were going to be, and I started throwing them down like dealing cards after the rain, picked them all up, take them to the laundry and do that. But it's unfortunate, but most of the leaks were around penetrations, like the chimney penetrations. Right. With that sense of transparency, doesn't leave a whole lot of room for the flashing, and the labor just didn't quite get it right. But now, today is a single-ply membrane roof, and as far as I know, it's held up very well.
As we both know, Wright was legendary for building houses that leaked. And to defend him, I thought about this a lot in what I learned in Racine at Johnson Wax and whatnot, is that he was such a futurist visionary in design that his brain was ahead of technology.
Yep.
So really, if he had the advanced polymers and elastomeric sealants, that he would not have had the problems, right?
Yeah, not a doubt in my mind that if the single-ply membranes were available then, that that's what it would be, because he just wanted to, if I could just do it with a single line, that's what he would do, and especially with the Usonians. And as you can see, the roof or the roofing, we can't see it from here.
But there was that egocentrism to him in that he went ahead and allowed his design to exceed its functionality, right?
Yeah, he was real lucky that he got people to pay for his experiments. And in retrospect, we're lucky too to have the architecture, even though you might have a bump or a burr every now and then. That's just all part of it.
Lighting, design lighting within.
Oh, the electric lights, the built-in.
And in what impresses you most contextually, time and place?
Well, geometric design, for one thing. Most of the lighting is built in the ceiling. It's in the ceiling roof framing. There's no attic at all. Wright would always do his designs, or the Usonians would have a unique design somewhere. It usually showed up in the fretwork, in the clerestories, and the lighting design. And this one has been attributed to the Bert Goodrich, the apprentice, with a little help, Aaron Green. It's supposed to be, and I asked Mimi, I said, I read where that was supposed to be an abstract fish because we were so close to the river.
Right.
And how Wright hooked his design with the environment. She couldn't verify that, but it does, I won't say it looks fishy, but it's all integral with the architecture.
Were fluorescents utilized at that time?
Under the cabinet work down in my room, down at the guest room there, there were fluorescents underneath a little shelf where you could read at night. You could turn the lights off and you read in bed, and then you could turn that when you were ready to go to bed. So we had the fluorescents, and then they had floor lamps. So those three items, just simple but smart indirect lighting. And the other good thing about living or staying in the house, once came night and the curtains were drawn, then the lighting would change, would start to pop out all of the edges and three-dimensional, makes it more three-dimensional because you'd have an up light here and a down light there. Mm-hmm. And it never got old, and it never got, I've been around here 40-plus years, and it's just never a dull moment for me.
Yeah. All right, well, sadly, we have to say sayonara. So if somebody wanted to learn more, where would you direct them?
Website Wright in Alabama. I'm Robert Witten. I'm an architect. I've studied Wright since I was 15. I'm still practicing, so that's pretty much my background. I do a docent here every other Sunday, so I will be glad to take anybody through and tell them all about it. And I guess I'm blessed because I can still hear Mimi's voice in my head, and it's something I like to share.
Thank you for sharing.
Well, you're welcome.
And I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Alabama. We'll see you here.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world.